In taping these lectures by Father John Hardin, S.J., on the principles and practice of formation in the religious life, it has been necessary from time to time to retape or re-record because of excessive tape or surface noise. The substitute voice is Robert Warnock, but the ideas, the words, the conclusions are all Father John Hardin, S.J., namely, how to distinguish temptations from inspiration. First, a question: how to distinguish temptations from inspirations? First, let us describe each term. And I would like to emphasize the importance of a clear definition for our purpose of temptation on the one hand and inspiration on the other. And here I am speaking as a man trained in the spirituality of St. Ignatius. Others would put it differently, and this is the way we were taught. Temptation. A temptation is an impulse permitted by God, but instigated by the devil. With the devil using our concupiscence or the bad example of others, urging us to commit sin. This is a definition of temptation that, if properly understood, can save you a lot of grief and help you in many ways. A temptation is an impulse permitted by God, instigated by the devil, and using our concupiscence or the bad example of others, urging us to commit sin. What then is an inspiration? Inspiration is an impulse originated by the Holy Spirit and using our good tendencies or the good example of others, urging us to practice virtue. Inspiration is an impulse originated by the Holy Spirit, using our good tendencies or the good example of others, urging us to practice virtue. You'll notice in both cases we postulate that behind the temptation is somehow the evil spirit, and behind every inspiration is the Holy Spirit. This is the theology of St. Ignatius. What do we mean when we say how to distinguish? What we mean by that is how to recognize the source of our impulses. We've got all sorts of urges, impulses. You name them, we've got them. The point behind this distinction is to distinguish by recognizing the source of the impulse. Whether the impulses we experience are from the devil or from the Holy Spirit. And I always pick the devil first, because once you recognize the devil, the opposite is recognizing the Holy Spirit. This subject is the bottom line of the spiritual life. All the goodwill, all the generosity in the world can be wasted effort unless my mind is able to distinguish between impulse and impulse, between urge and urge. So I've got the urge. So I'm being impelled to do this or not to do that. I am bursting with generosity, but I'm not sure whether the impulse is a good one. And not all inspirations, when experienced, are holy impulses. Not all temptations, when experienced, are sinful. That's where the subtlety of the religious life belongs. The voice urging virtue can cause us pain, and temptation can give us great satisfaction. So another way of putting this, how to discern the difference between the origin of our desires, whether this origin is demonic or divine. Just because I have a strong, powerful desire to practice an act of charity does not ipso facto mean that that desire is from God. Otherwise, the spiritual life would be simplicity itself, and it isn't. It is highly complex. Now, two presuppositions. And first, the meaning of each. Now, what do we mean by how to distinguish? What are we talking about? And the point is, what are the presuppositions of what we are talking about? There are two. First, the supposition, all our desires, unless we're unconscious, wide awake desires, all our desires are being constantly influenced by intelligent forces outside of our own mind and will. That's the ABC of the spiritual life. None of our thoughts in the mind, none of our desires in the will, are ever entirely just our own. It takes faith to believe it, but you better believe it. The second presupposition. These forces that are at work outside of our mind and will are ultimately God or the devil. The adverb ultimately is important because both God and the evil spirit use us, use our nature, in one case to inspire, in the other case to instigate, and use other people. Use the weather outside. Use the time of the day. Use, you name it, what? But the focus of our reflections on how to distinguish temptations from inspirations presupposes what Ignatius told his followers to never forget, and never teach anyone in the spiritual life without making this clear. And as I hope, faithful son of Ignatius, I am trying to make it clear. Our minds are never operating alone. Our wills are never acting alone. That behind the mind and the will are ultimately whatever other proximate forces are at work, ultimately the good spirit and the evil spirit. Now the rules for discernment. Before I go on, I'd like to recommend to you, if you don't have copies of this, get it. It's due for revision and reprint, but the publisher just hasn't been able to get to it. I'm talking about the book, All My Liberty, chapter 12, pages 131 to 143, on the discernment of spirits. The single most practical thing we should know, single most practical thing in the spiritual life. Read what's there, because I will touch on some of the items but go beyond it, because I will be assuming that you either have or will have access to that chapter. All I know is that living as a priest, and the 18th of June, I'll be a priest 35 years. God has been very good to me and gave me a great master of the spiritual life as my novice master and what we call cushion master. That's the third year of novitiate that we make after our ordination. And as a priest, he urged me and helped me to set down for myself, and each one of us is different, basic rules for the discernment of spirits. You will never do anything great for God, never, unless you have mastered what's behind this discernment of spirits. All the saints were masters of discernment, because the God who inspires us is the hidden God, and the devil who tempts us is very clever. And we better be able to recognize God, though hidden, when he is acting on us, and the devil when he tries to influence our actions. There are three basic principles for discernment. One of the books that, if the Lord spares me, I would like to write is a good practical manual on the discernment of spirits. I've seen good people ruin their lives and the lives of others for failure to discern in the mind. First basic principle. God and the angels, and God uses the angels, the good angels, on the one hand, and the devil and his agents on the other hand. I don't hesitate, and I say this knowing that I am being recorded, and the recording will be copied. Andrew Greeley is an agent of the devil. I say this with complete certitude. So God and the angels on the one hand, the devil and his angels on the other, act according to their respective natures. First clue. In other words, God, when he acts on the human soul, always acts like God. And the devil, when he acts on the soul, acts like the devil. Second principle. The good and evil spirits, for Ignatius, it is always plural. Good spirits, singular, and evil spirits, plural. But the good spirit, for Ignatius, is both God and his angels, so we can pluralize both. Good spirits and evil spirits. Whenever they act on a human soul, they always act for opposite purposes. They have not just different, but contrary motives. And third principle, both kinds of spirits adapt themselves to persons, occasions, and circumstances. In other words, the Holy Spirit and his angels adapt themselves to the person, and so does the evil spirit. First of all, and this is always, the good spirit knows better than we what kind of people we are. And the evil spirits try their best to find out. You say the wrong thing to the wrong person at the wrong time, and you get no action. The purpose of the influence from both God and his angels, and the devil and his agents, is to get action. So adaptation is built into the way the good and the evil spirits influence our lives. Now, some practical norms. What are some of the signs by which we can recognize a temptation? Well, let me preface this with a very important parenthesis. I am speaking to people who want to do God's will, who are serious about divine grace being an invitation, inviting our response. Because unless we make that distinction, nothing really works. Let's go back to our third basic principle, adaptation. In general, I never tire of repeating this, no matter how many times I may have told people, because I've got to keep telling myself. For a person who is not serious about doing God's will, God and the devil act in different ways. We said both adapt themselves. They sure do. What kind of adaptation would you expect the devil to make with sinful people? What does the devil want these people to do? What they're doing. The last thing the devil wants to do is to disturb their peace of mind. What he wants is to induce complacency, smugness. He doesn't want anything to ruffle the untroubled, perverse conscience which this person is living with. Now, we won't finish this vast subject today, but let me just illustrate by an experience I've had within the last 2 days. There is a father whom I have been, well, he's a father of a family that I've been counseling spiritually for a dozen or more years. He lives at some distance, but he welcomes my advice. He has a boy who's gone off the deep end. In his 20s, he's gone on drugs, and God knows what kind of a life he's living. He went out to the West Coast to be as far away as possible from the family, living in some flop house, and just causing great anguish to his parents. I promised the father I would investigate in New York from what I knew was the best expert in dealing with this kind of person. It happens to be a Father Daniel Egan. You might remember that. A Franciscan. I happened to reach him, explained the situation to him, and here's what he told me. There is no power on earth that will change that boy unless something shakes him out of his complacency. Either you must wait until God does something drastic in his life to wake him up, or that somehow you might create a situation to shock him. He said, I'm not recommending this, but he said it might possibly work. Most of these people on drugs have committed some crime by now. The police have so many of these people on their roster. The jails are too crowded. They can't possibly arrest them all. If the family has a police connection in California and some friend on the police force who would, having studied the case, shock the boy into telling him why he is in trouble with the law, well, unless the young man is frightened, nothing will change his life. So how are we going to expect the evil spirits with people who are living in sin to operate? Well, like the evil spirits. A person living an evil life is what the devil wants. Keep the person that way. Whereas the good spirits with people who are living evil lives, what term do we have that goes back to our maybe childhood days when a person is in sin and God is trying to arouse that person from his state of sin. Well, what do we call that? Finish the sentence. Blank of conscience. What kind of a conscience would God cause a person who is living in sin to have so that he would come out of his evil state? A troubled conscience. We better learn at least. See, the devils go through instruction. You know that, don't you? They get trained by Lucifer. And this is the first thing that Lucifer teaches his underlings. Do not allow anything to trouble the conscience of a person who is doing our demonic will. God then causes trouble. Pangs of conscience. Have you heard that before? Well, if we're trying to do God's will, what do you expect the evil spirit to cause in us? The evil spirit, how do you expect him to act on people who are trying to do God's will? To cause them what? Trouble, difficulty, anxiety, worry, sadness. This is not a sentence I've just said. This is the bedrock, the single most practically important principle in the spiritual life. To know this and believe it is to be on the road to sanctity. If you find yourself habitually disturbed or worried by something, though you want to do God's will, assume, just assume, it is not caused by God, but caused by the evil spirits. What are we talking about? We're asking how we can discern or distinguish between the operation of the good spirit and the operation of the evil spirit in our lives and specifically on our minds. As we mentioned before, our minds are never alone, never uninfluenced by spiritual forces outside of us. They are constantly being affected by the good spirit, who is God and his angels, and the evil spirit, who is Satan and his minions. The three basic principles, then, are that God and the angels on the one hand and the devil and his agents on the other act according to their respective natures. God's influence is always good. The devil's influence is always evil. Second, the good and evil spirits, being different in nature, act for opposite purposes. The good spirit, that is, the Holy Spirit and the angels, are always intent on our moral improvement and doing God's will. The evil spirit is always intent on our destruction and the commission of sin. And third, each set of spirits adapts themselves, that is, they adjust to different persons, different occasions, and different circumstances. Both the good and evil spirits are very adaptable. Given those three principles now, we want to look at some practical norms. Concretely, how can we, as far as it is possible, for us to distinguish, recognize first a temptation? In other words, what are signs of temptation? We're looking at the kind of thoughts that we're having. First, sign of a temptation, if that which is in our mind or stimulated in our mind by what we see, hear, or read about is against the church's teaching. So the first sure sign of a temptation is if that which, or we're not sure if it's a temptation, if it's against the church's teaching. Second, if it is against the church's approval. In other words, there are many things which the church does not formally teach, but which she does approve. Thirdly, is it against obedience, depending on my state of life? And this, when I speak to married people, applies, for example, to children. When they want to do whatever they want to do contrary to their parents' wishes, the odds are that's a temptation. But I liked it. That's not the point. Does mother like it? No, she doesn't like it. Well then, a little child, you are being tempted.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.